The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Andrew Kleiman is the guest this week, and we discuss his essay at the New Left Project entitled Harvey versus Marx on Capitalism's Crisis. It's Wednesday, March 18th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll be hearing clips from The Big Chill, Slavoj Žižek, Brendan Cooney, Nirvana, and The Piano Cat, and an instrumental version of A Whiter Shade of Pale. Right now, you're listening to the theme from Groucho Marx's You Bet Your Life. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Brendan Cooney explaining the declining rate of profit, or the tendency for the rate of profit to decline, and then you'll hear Andrew Kleiman and I discuss Marxist entertainment.
We can't blame crisis solely on financial capital. The monstrous bubbles of fictitious values it creates are only a problem if there isn't enough value in the economy to back up all those symbols of value. We must also look to the productive side of the capitalist class and ask, why isn't there enough value in the economy to back up all of that fictitious value? How come there aren't enough wages to pay off those mortgages? Why does the government have to go into debt in order to bail out investment firms and banks? To answer these questions, we need some theory about the rate of accumulation, that is, the rate at which value is created in a capitalist society. The theory of the falling rate of profit is such a theory. The theory of the falling rate of profit argues that the basic way in which value is created in a capitalist society contains a basic contradiction which destabilizes accumulation. If not offset by some countervailing influence, this will cause capitalism to go into crisis. The basic argument is actually pretty simple. If capitalists see the concrete stage of commodity production as an annoying step in between an initial investment, M, and profit, M1, it is in their interest to decrease the amount of time spent in this concrete stage while getting the most possible value out of it. This is basically what it means to increase efficiency. Workers produce more commodities per hour, thus increasing the physical productivity relative to the initial investment. The problem is that the more efficient capitalists are at producing commodities, the less those commodities are worth. And this is simply because increased efficiency means less labor input per commodity, and therefore less value. Meanwhile, more spending on labor-saving, efficient machines. So the very actions that capitalists take to generate more profit create a falling rate of profit. This theory that increased efficiency drives down the rate of profit has aspects that are both intuitively commonsensical and aspects that seem illogical. It makes intuitive sense that the more there is of a commodity, the less it is worth. It doesn't seem to make sense that capitalists would continue to behave in ways that drove down their own rate of profit. Let's look more closely at this process and try to unravel the mystery behind it. The expansion of value is the essence of capitalism. Capitalists exist to turn raw materials, tools, and labor power into commodities of greater value, to sell them for money, and then to start the process all over again the next day. Competition between capitalists creates a race to lower prices relative to rival capitalists. But if price were ever lowered below the actual value of a commodity, capitalists couldn't make a profit at all. The only way to lower the price of a commodity and thus outcompete a rival is to produce something more cheaply than a rival capitalist. How is this done? by increasing the productivity of labor. Remember, commodities' values are equal to their socially necessary labor time, the amount of time it takes in general for a commodity to be produced under average conditions. Let's say you're a capitalist who makes widgets, and the average firm produces 10 widgets an hour per worker, but your firm only produces 5. In order to make the same amount of profit as your competitors, you would have to sell your widgets at a higher price. You can't get away with charging more for your widgets because people will just go buy from someone else who can make them cheaper. You will be forced to get your workforce to achieve average productivity or else go out of business. You will be forced to achieve the socially necessary labor time. Now, if you can get your workers to produce 15 widgets an hour, then you are producing at under the socially necessary labor time. This means you can sell your widgets at slightly less than the average cost, outselling your rivals, and getting more profit per widget than them. How do you achieve more efficient production? Obviously, you can make your workers work harder, but you will encounter some opposition if you try to get them to work too hard. After all, workers are people with a certain level of tolerance for their own exploitation. We can assume that all of your rivals are making their workers work equally hard. Your only other option is technical innovation. If you invest in better machines, new machines, fancy computers, new conveyor belts, you can make your workers more productive. And this is exactly what capitalists do all the time. This is the motor behind the dazzling technological dynamism of a capitalist society. Once you've achieved a more efficient production system, other capitalists are going to want to do the same. It's hard to keep technological advances secret for long. Once all of your competitors are producing 15 widgets an hour per worker, the socially necessary labor time of a widget goes down. The value of the commodity has fallen, and with it the amount of profit that can be made from it. The actions of individuals competing to make a profit by producing at less than the socially necessary labor time eventually lowers the socially necessary labor time itself, thus undermining the aggregate profit rate. Let me say that again. The actions of individuals competing to make a profit by producing at less than the socially necessary labor time eventually lowers the socially necessary labor time, thus undermining aggregate profit.
Andrew Kleinman is the author of two books, Reclaiming Marx's Capital and The Failure of Capitalist Production. He is now an emeritus professor in economics at Pace University, and he is also a regular guest, or he was a regular guest on the Diet Soap podcast, and I hope to keep him around now that it's called Zero Squared. His latest series of essays are entitled Harvey versus Marx on Capitalism's Crisis, and we'll be discussing David Harvey and the tendency of the rate of profit to fall today. Andrew Kleinman, welcome to Zero Squared.
Thanks very much, Doug. I think this is my first time on your new program.
I'm really glad to bring you to hopefully a new audience. So the essay you published at the New Left Project, those are both online right now, and that's what we're going to be discussing today. They're in response to a draft paper that David Harvey posted.
Right. The draft paper is called Crisis Theory and the Falling Rate of Profit.
Why is Harvey even engaging with the Marxist theory of the falling rate of profit? I mean, is Harvey different from a lot of other Marxists who take Marxist theory to be basically broken, inconsistent, and needing to be improved? And does his engagement with Marxist theory of the falling rate of profit indicate that he's taking Marx more seriously, or that Marxists today are taking Marx more seriously?
No, he's always had disagreements, certain dislike of the crisis theory that Marx left us, the crisis theory rooted in the law of the tendential fall in the rate of profit, even from like his first sort of major Marxist period work, Limits to Capital. So the reason he's engaging, I think, with it now is the Great Recession and its prolonged aftermath have put first of all, crisis theory back on the agenda, and they've put the crisis theory rooted in Marx's law back on the agenda. And I think it's become increasingly difficult for people just to ignore the crisis theory and the, let me just call it, Marx's law. What they face it as an alternative to what they're saying. And so they have to respond, and the responses are generally, you know, negative in various ways, but mostly dismissive. And I think that if I had one word to describe what Harvey was doing, would be dismissive.
So it's not a change at all from the usual approach to Marx's theory itself on the American Marxist left. He makes some specific charges. He says that those who blame the law of the tendency for the fall and the rate of profit for the crisis are monocausal theorists. What does he mean by that?
Well, monocausal means that you, when you try to explain something, you point to a single cause, one cause. That is pretty damning in a world that we know is pretty complex. It indicates a certain narrow focus, maybe dogmatism. It indicates that you have got blinders on. And I mean, it's kind of ludicrous, for instance, to say the Great Recession had one cause. Now, the alternative is, of course, to recognize many potential causes. However, within that, there are various ways, of course, of doing that. And one is to say, well, there's a certain structure. It's all empirical in the end. I mean, what does explain is what explains in a particular case, and I don't think any kind of rules universally apply. But potentially one can say there's a structure of the various elements, you know, different causes, and they combine and interrelate in a certain way, and some are, for instance, underlying causes, some are immediate triggers, so forth and so on. Or one can have, for instance, just a flat space and say, you know, here's just an array of different factors without kind of looking at the interrelations of them or any sort of structured attempted explanation. Harvey's charge of monocausality really has two parts. One, he says that Marx's law of the tendential fall in the rate of profit, or tendency of the rate of profit to fall, that law is itself monocausal. Okay, in other words, there is one cause, supposedly, that it asserts of the rate of profit falling. The other part of Harvey's charge is that modern-day proponents, supporters of the law and of the crisis theory based on it, we give monocausal explanations based on the law, and we do so in a way that typically excludes other possibilities from consideration, other potential causes. My analogy to the universal law of gravitation had to do really with the first part. What was Marx doing, and was he providing a monocausal explanation when he puts forward the law of tendential fall and the rate of profit? Harvey says, yes, it's monocausal. And he says, you know, when Marx first lays out the law, he says labor-saving technological change produces a tendency for the rate of profit to fall. And then, you know, Marx sort of smuggles in a bunch of things that can counteract that, and he smuggles in the financial system later, but then he's sort of dropping the assumptions on which the law is based, and without those assumptions, it's not really a law, okay? And these assumptions are such as to exclude major, major portions of reality. So what I did is, just to make clear what the issues are here, I made a little analogy to somebody who uses the universal law of gravitation appeals to it in order to explain why apples tend to fall off trees. The apple example obviously comes from the legend about Isaac Newton. Okay, so right. I say, let's say that, you know, you appeal to the universal law of gravitation, that's Newton's law, to explain why apples tend to fall off trees. And when you do that, you aren't talking about, well, the wind blowing and other factors, and you're not talking about air resistance, which is an impediment or counteracting factor. You're saying, look, why do apples tend to fall from trees? Universal law of gravitation. Okay, but that doesn't mean that you're assuming that those other things don't exist, and it doesn't mean that you're building a model that excludes them. And then I went on and on with that that analogy a bit. But basically, one has to recognize what an explanation is. It's not a list of every potential cause. Okay, and it's always contextual, you know? So if you say, why do apples tend to fall from trees? You're not saying, I'm going to give you a list of every cause, but there's a certain tendency, you know, it's everything tends to fall. Okay, it's a universal law of gravitation. So everything tends to fall. Well, that is very important in regard to why apples tend to fall from trees. It's not the only thing that matters. And there are things that can keep apples from falling from the trees, you know, or impede their fall and so forth. You know, so then I say, and let's say after I talk about the universal law of gravitation, I go on to mention air resistance and I go on to mention the blowing of the wind. That doesn't mean that I'm vacillating, you know, or I'm unsure about the status of the universal law of gravitation. It doesn't mean that I'm tacitly admitting that the law does not hold in the real world, but only in a vacuum. So kind of point by point, I went through the various charges that Harvey makes against Marx's presentation of the law of the exponential fall and the rate of profit. And shows that by the same logic, you could apply it to somebody who says, gee, why do apples tend to fall from trees? It's because of gravity.
This particular charge that Harvey makes and your refutation of it seems to comment on more than just this issue. I found that in lots of different realms in academic, but from academics, you know, I'm not in the academic world, but that there's this tendency to just want to avoid any explanation because it would be too reductive. You know, it seems to me like, I mean, I've heard Harvey say that he learned to read Marx from a post-structuralist point of view in the 80s at one point. And that seems to fit nicely onto this, you know, argument here that he's wanting to take a perspective on the causes of the crisis that basically avoid any kind of meta narrative, to use that word, or any explanation, really, ultimately any understandable primary explanation for events.
I'll tell you what I think. First of all, this kind of idea of multi-causality, you know, as a flat space, there's all these different causes. The postmodernists and post-structuralists did not really invent that. That, I think, was a feature of standard positivist social science long before. And that's where Harvey got his start. You know, as a purely, you know, pure empiricist, positivist social scientist. It might be an inheritance from that. Certainly, what Harvey is now doing, and you see it a bit in the paper to which I responded, my articles, well, it's really one article, the two parts in New Left Project, also cites another article of his from 2012. And I think you see it more clearly in that article. I would say probably the postmodernist aspect is that he's rejecting depth. In other words, he's rejecting, not that he's saying it's necessarily incorrect, but he's just rejecting a distinction between essence and appearance and a certain structure to an explanation or a certain causal structure that goes along with that. I mean, what he's been doing recently is, well, you know, there's a lot of contradictions, 17 contradictions in capitalism, and there's a circuit of capital that Marx talks about, and it's got, you know, all these moments in time and all of these aspects, and kind of anything can go wrong, and the explanation, such as it is to say this is a contradiction of capitalism, or this is, you know, a disturbance or breakdown of the circuit of capital. I don't know that it really explains anything. It puts it in a certain structure. Well, I wouldn't even say structure. It basically organizes things neatly. It's a certain taxonomy. It's a way of classifying things, mm-hmm. I think is mostly what he's doing.
You have the word or the label, and you don't need to think more deeply than that.
I think he has very deep reasons for rejecting depth. It's not, I mean, the way you say it, it sounds like, gee, this guy's a joker. He's not a joker. In his 2012 paper, he says, you know, he taught Volume 2 of Capital, and it was boring to his students. And, you know, it's going online, his lectures, and he's trying to make it interesting. And it's, like, really, really hard. You know, on the other hand, people, like, really get interested in the things that affect their daily lives. You know, so if you talk about being, you know, cheated by your telephone company or something, that can get people interested. So why privilege something that is hard and people don't immediately experience against something that really does interest them and is part of the story? You know, I think that's his concern.
But I'm not sure what you, if you really listen to what you just said, that that you really argued strongly that he's not a joker. But okay, so we'll move on.
We join the conversation as the professor discusses his latest work in the area.
Where I'm doing at least some of my work, and that's some of the developments in the philosophy of science, or just in the kind of general social theoretical outlook on science, especially in the social sciences, have kind of internalized or embraced certain very basic ideas that I think, as an aside, are somewhat undialectical, but basic ideas that result ultimately in a kind of anti-essentialism, or in at least a denial of a kind of a stable aspect of society that can then form the basis of theory. And what happens is usually it's accompanied by a couple of other key moves, one of them being a kind of non-hierarchical view of society, something very close to a kind of a liberal view of society with kind of transparent power relations. And there's a sense, at least, that when this happens, that the project of Marx, at least the project as Marx kind of developed it as he was responding to critics, that project kind of takes a direct hit. And it's not one that is really, in the end, very embracing, if I can use that word, of Marx's actual project.
What was Marx's understanding of science, and was that the typical concept of or philosophy of science at the time?
Well, I think Marx had a kind of multi-sided idea of science. One, it was largely going to be associated with a broader materialist outlook, and so he was going to kind of repudiate the idea that there were a priori when it came to sociological analysis, But certainly in his science, he makes all of the kind of standard moves that we would expect to see from someone who's carefully kind of scrutinizing the world. It's deductive, it's inductive. He's sometimes filling in meanings. It's what Peirce would call abductive. It's kind of guessing at things. But most importantly, it's retroductive in the sense that he does feel that the way to explain the world is to distinguish between appearance and essence, and to then retroductively explain the things that we see in terms of the more essential or enduring or abiding features of the social formation, and particularly of capitalism.
Affordable, transportable cellular phone is here. Quality made by General Electric. This cellular phone features 832 channel capacity, 30 number memory speed.
Small words are hard to read, which is why at Nokia we make our screens big, so they're easier to read. Inspired technology with a human touch. Nokia.
Can you hear me now? Good. Can you hear me now?
How do you build America's Good. Largest wireless network?
Can you hear me now? Good.
By never being satisfied. Can you hear me?
What's my day look like?
Not bad. Only two meetings today.
Can I walk to the Belvedere Hotel from here?
Here are directions to Belvedere Hotel.
Read me that text.
New message from Sarah Russell. See you soon.
Welcome to life. We regret to inform you that your previous existence ended on January the 14th, 2052, following a road traffic accident. However, your consciousness was successfully uploaded to the Life Network by your primary care provider. Life contains over 30,000 unique activities, networking with millions of other digitized minds, and the ability to contact undigitized friends and family. Please accept these terms and conditions in order to continue life. Your attention is particularly drawn to section 2.
He makes some other claims, one of which I thought was remarkable, that he says that growth in the global labor force since 1980 demonstrates that there hasn't been a decline in the rate of profit. Because, you know, he starts off by attacking your theory, and then he says some things about the empirical data that you use, and this is one of those claims there. How is he wrong? I think I know how he's wrong, but how is he wrong about this?
Let's start off with what the growth of the labor force globally does indicate. It's damn close to saying employment increased markedly. And that then takes you, it's pretty reasonable to say, the amount, mass of surplus value or profit that the capitalists have raked in probably increased massively. Okay? So, especially when you get a big growth, like what he's talking about, 1.1 million people over the space of a quarter century. So, I'm willing to accept that the amount of profit that the capitalists have gotten worldwide increased markedly over this period. But we're supposedly speaking here about the rate of profit. And that's a ratio. It's not only the profit, it's profit as a percentage of the amount of capital invested to generate that profit. Invested in machinery, invested in all kinds of things. So Marx called it the capital invested or advanced. So What you're doing with the rate of profit is you're saying per dollar of investment, how much profit are you getting? It's a rate of return. You know, you invest a dollar, you get 4 cents. The rate of return is 4%. The rate of profit is 4%. So, you know, if you invest $100 million, you're going to get a whole lot more profit than if you invest $1. Okay, but you might be getting a much lower rate of profit at two different times. And that's the same problem that his statistic is encountering. It's only the top number in the ratio. Okay, if we're talking about the whole ratio, you can't just say, here's what happened to the top number. You have to look at what happens to the top number compared to what's happening to the bottom number. And he just doesn't address that at all.
Failing to distinguish between like total profits worldwide and the rate of profit, as you described it, it's the kind of mistake that a newbie like me might make, you know, trying to figure this out. But it's just not the kind of thing that I'd expect from someone who's been teaching capital for 40 years. How is it that Harvey's interpretation of Marx leaves the door open for this kind of mistake?
Yeah, well, one thing I should say is it's not only that, you know, one would be unlikely to make this mistake just on one's own, but Marx spends what I consider an inordinate amount of time and space in his presentation going into the amount, mass of profit versus the rate of profit. And he makes a big deal about this because this is an old, old problem that we face. You know, there's certain skepticism as to the rate of profit falling because the mass of profit is so big, you know. Or, their rate of profit is falling, but they're investing so much that they're getting more total profit. So, that, you know, why does the rate of profit matter? Marx just thinks that's kind of hilarious. So he spends a lot of time on that issue. So not only should one not make that mistake, one should especially not make that mistake if one's paid attention to what Marx has said and maybe even read the text recently. I don't think it's a question of Harvey's particular interpretation of Marx leading him to make that mistake. It may well be a matter of him wanting to dispose of the law of the tendential fall and the rate of profit and not really being equipped, as he admits in the essay, to dealing with a lot of the statistical material. So he takes a statistic that he is aware of, tries to apply it and do a kind of immediate dismissal, and it doesn't work. But I tell you, it's not just Harvey.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody can make a mistake. Even anybody can make a serious mistake for a variety of reasons. I think what we have to ask about is what is wrong with the environment in which this discussion is occurring? What is wrong with, you know, the way that, for instance, this gets presented at a conference, goes unchallenged, the other side does not have an opportunity to engage, the other side's not invited to engage. Where are the sort of checks and balances and the review process to make sure that the public isn't being misled, bamboozled, and so forth? I think that this is one of the reasons why sort of the revival of Marx, such as it's been, hasn't really generated any fruits in the last several years. It all takes place in a way where everybody gets to say what they want, and the audience, you know, the readers get to decide what they like. But when we're dealing with scientific questions, scholarly questions, questions of explanation, and so forth, it's not a question of what you like. But the problem is the readers don't have the background, don't have the time, and so forth, to evaluate things pretty much other than on the basis of what they happen to like, what they find appealing, what political conclusions appeal to them, and so forth. So there's something seriously going on wrong with the fact that you get really egregious errors, not in one case. I don't mean to pick on Harvey. You know, and anybody can make a mistake. I make mistakes, you know. But this happens again and again and again. I wrote a response to this thing that was published in Platypus Review about a month before my thing on Harvey appeared. It was written by a guy named James Hartfield. The whole thing was just a mass of errors. So it's not, you know, David Harvey as such. There's a certain atmosphere. There's a certain lack of real engagement and lack of real interest in engagement and lack of concern for truth and all kinds of other things that are driving this discussion such as it is.
When it comes to figuring out like how Marx is received in this culture and why it's received in this way. It's easy to say that the problem is a certain kind of academic culture, but it's obvious to me as someone who's like a science fiction writer that what goes on in the realm of left academics and left thinking is not very different from what goes on in the realm of the arts, where you are, or in the realm of literature. What you want to do, the primary thing you're aiming at doing, is gaining an audience when you are a writer. And there is no other higher standard for fiction writing than that. I mean, there are other standards, but when you're working on, you know, making a career for yourself, those other standards are secondary by far. But in other realms, like in the realm of the sciences, say, and I would think that there are other realms as well, but they don't spring to mind at the moment. That's not what determines success. And the fact that Marx's thinking has been shoved into that arena of basically the competing on the marketplace of ideas as entertainment, basically, it seems to me that that's not necessarily the fault of individuals or individual Marxists or academics. It's something that's going on politically and socially, that there's probably some theory to explain how that's happened. But
yeah, I think you hit two or three nails on the head there. I absolutely agree with everything you say. I mean, this, I think, is some of the legacy of postmodernism, to make respectable an effacement of the distinction between, let's call it, science and art, and, you know, gaming the audience and so forth becomes like one's highest calling. The point about this not being a problem of individuals, I think, is really key. You know, it's not that people in the natural sciences, you know, or medicine or engineering are more pure, noble, altruistic, scientific in their personal outlook. You know, they're subject to the same things that drive everybody else. But there's a certain process, certain set of institutions, rules, procedures in certain disciplines that prevent this from just being the way things are. People can't get away with this stuff. In other disciplines, they get away with it. So basically, my point is, and really I owe this point to Alan Freeman. We've written a little bit about it, but the basic thought, the insight was really his originally. I mean, everybody's going to try to get away with saying stuff that it doesn't matter whether they know what they're talking about. Not, you know, sure, if I can get somebody to accept it, why do I have to go through any extra effort? It's easier not to do it that way, right? Everybody wants to try that. But in certain disciplines, it doesn't work. In certain disciplines, it does work. And that's the academic realm. But a lot of this discussion now is not really taking place in academia. It's taking place, you know, on the internet and so forth. And there's certain standards there. And in the sort of internet culture, yeah, it works. You can get away with not demonstrating your claims. You can get away with making false statements, mischaracterization of what other people say. You can get away with all of that. There's no rules being enforced. So the real question is, what makes those disciplines that are not like that? Mathematics, engineering, medicine, you know, the natural sciences, what makes them different?
I think it's because they're serving something other than just the market. They're, you know, they're, when it comes to like
right.
nuclear physics or something that they have to, you know, you get that wrong, there are real serious consequences, material consequences right away.
Right. Right. People don't want their bridges to collapse.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
They don't want the drugs that they're taking, you know, to kill them. They want the drugs that they're taking to heal them, etc. Okay. So the public cares that in certain disciplines, they get things right rather than wrong. So certain rules and institutions get set up to separate the wheat from the chaff, what's right from what's wrong. That is not happening in the arts. It's hard, you know, to say right and wrong in art. It's not happening in the softer social science disciplines. It's not happening in this kind of realm that we're talking about, which I guess one would call economic theory. Because the point is not right and wrong. The point is not true and false. The point is not what works as an explanation and what doesn't work as an explanation. Something else is going on. And when that happens, the discussion is not authentic. It's not genuine. Okay, it's a way of posturing or whatever. And we've talked about that, you know, people asserting their identity and cheerleading and, you know, fandom and all of that kind of thing going on.
One way to think of it simply is this is what Marxism is when there is no revolutionary movement. You know, when there's no project for it to serve. But at the same time, I want the ideas to help formulate, to help bring together a movement. And I think that's how it has to happen. But the ideas right now have some other material basis than a movement. So I don't know. It seems like a Chinese finger trap or something. And, you know, not that easy, actually. It seems like a real paradox to me. But maybe you've got some good thoughts on that.
I think that there is a certain discipline that having an actual large working class, mass basis and theorists being in tune with and in dialogue with that, I think that would create a certain discipline. I'm not sure that it would address the kinds of things that I'm talking about.
Go on, because I'm not
right. I mean, I hesitate to say too much, but I think it would be hard. I don't know that this issue has ever really been adequately addressed, really in the whole history of the left. I'm thinking of Marxist, not Marxist, and so forth. I mean, there is a certain strand of thinking that I reject, which is that ideas are tested in practice. The reason I reject that is, of course, it's true in a certain sense. The problem is that the real cash value, to use a pragmatist expression, the real cash value of ideas are tested in practice is that it's pragmatism. It's whatever works is true. I mean, that's the crudest form of pragmatism you could have. Well, we know things can work in a certain sense and be untrue by a normal use of the word true. You know, you can get elected by telling lies, and that works if you want to be elected.
Right, and religion organized the world for, you know, a thousand years or more, right? And I would go out on a limb and say the ideas of most religions are untrue, the basic ideas. So, yeah, I understand. That's not... That isn't the ultimate standard. This is why I have the problem. It's that I want the ideas or our commitment to thinking as close as we can to the truth to be the basis for our self-organization. But I find that what happens is that we are unable to do the kind of thinking that we need unless we have something else disciplining us. Some other
right.
task.
I mean, the only way to overcome this problem and it has to be ongoing, and we have to be so far in advance where we are now, is to so thoroughly overcome, break down the separation between the thinkers and the doers, between theory and practice, that it really does get appreciated in the mass movements that, you know, we need right answers rather than wrong answers. You know, not just politically expedient answers versus politically inexpedient answers. Okay? But we need the truth. When that takes hold and there's a mass movement that can discipline what goes on in think tanks, what goes on among theorists, what goes on in academia, you know, and people are in a relationship with a mass movement that is demanding right answers versus wrong answers, not just expedient and inexpedient answers, then we're going to get somewhere. Not until then, I don't think.
Well, nobody thinks they're a bad person. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not even claiming that people always think they're doing the right thing. They may know that they're doing something dishonest or insensitive or manipulative, but they almost always think there's a good reason for doing it. They almost always think that it'll turn out for the best in the end. And even if it's just that it turns out best for them. Because by definition, what's best for them is what's best. Mm-hmm. Now look, in addition, you instantly come up against a question of style. My style may be too direct. Perhaps given my style, I seem more nakedly opportunistic or jerky or... what was the other thing?
Manipulative?
Whatever. But really all that's happening is that I'm trying to get what I want. Which is what everybody does. It's just that some of their styles are so warm or charming or sincere or otherwise phony, you don't realize they're just trying to get what they want. So you see, my transparent efforts are in a way much more honest and admirable.
Why is it what you just said strikes me as a massive rationalization?
Don't knock rationalization. Where would we be without it? I don't know anyone who'd get through the day without two or three juicy rationalizations. They're more important than sex.
Ah, oh, come on. Nothing's more important than sex.
Oh, yeah? Have you ever gone a week without a rationalization?
You always can find a nice way, as we usually put it, to rationalize it, to tell yourself a story about it. So the radical conclusion here is that, and this is another deepest insight of Judeo-Christian tradition, it's that the ultimate truth, the truth of you as a unique person, where you really stand, is not when you go deep into yourself and the deepest sincere self-identification or whatever. At that level, we usually lie. That's not the ultimate truth. When we who stand in a Christian tradition, when we speak about redemption, blah, blah, all this, is something totally different than this Gnostic or pagan perspective of going deep into yourself, finding this inner truth about yourself and so on and so on. Precisely, this level of inner truth is a lie, is the point of lying.
Back to Harvey's essay here for this book. He attempted to find textual support for a claim that Marx was ambivalent about the law of the tendency for the rate of profit to decline. How egregious was his misreading of Marx here?
Yeah, I don't know if it's his misreading of Marx in the strict sense of misreading a text or latching on to really flimsy bits of non-evidence and semi-evidence to make a case. For instance, Harvey says Marx vacillates between calling it a law or a tendency, or, you know, maybe splitting the different law of a tendency. Well, there's a difference between a tendency and a law. You know, a tendency is what happens in the world. Something tends to fall, apples, rate of profit. Then there's a law. Well, the tendential fall in the rate of profit, universal law of gravitation, that explains why it tends to fall. And law of a tendency isn't like splitting the difference. I mean, Marx's position was that all economic laws are laws of tendencies, because you can't really have a law of like that explains the exact movement in these variables, because all kinds of things are going on. So all you can really do is maybe identify a law that talks about the main tendencies that the thing experiences. That's one example. There are others. Harvey says, well, if you look at Marx's political writings like the Civil War in France, that's Marx's discussion of the period leading up to the Paris Commune and the Paris Commune. There's no mention of any law of the exponential fall in the rate of profit in, you know, Marx's discussion in the Civil War in France. Okay. What's that supposed to tell us, though? It's not an economic text. Marx doesn't mention surplus value, doesn't mention surplus labor, all kinds of other economic categories. Would Harvey want to say that, gee, Marx was ambivalent about surplus labor or surplus value? Did he come to doubt that these are meaningful or important concepts because they don't appear in a political text? Right? Those are a couple of instances.
Is he assuming his own conclusion here and then just looking, like cherry-picking out whatever kinds of evidence he can find in the text?
I think he's definitely trying to say, how can I get us away from this idea that Marx held to this law? Michael Heinrich, a German Marx scholar and so forth, a couple of years ago did the same thing, published a piece in Monthly Review. Monthly Review also dislikes Marx's law of the exponential fall on the rate of profit. And they look at all sorts of circumstantial, I can't even call it circumstantial evidence. It's ridiculous stuff like this. You know, another thing that Harvey does, well, Marx never came back to this issue after 1868. Well, does that mean he rejected what he had done? You know, what I do when I've solved a problem to my satisfaction, empirical problem, theoretical problem, I move on. It's pretty clear to me that Marx did the same thing, and I think, you know, probably Harvey does as well. Heinrich does as well. We get these things that are really just not evidence. They really don't stand up when you look at them. You know, if there was a text where Marx says, gee, you know, I have doubts about what I had earlier called a law of the exponential fall in the rate of profit. I don't really think it's a law anymore. I'm having second thoughts, you know. He doesn't even have to say I reject it conclusively. But if we had one single statement like the one I just gave you, I would think totally differently. But we don't have anything like that. We have nothing that can actually be said to be a statement of doubt, vacillation, or so forth from Marx. What we get is, gee, he used the word tendency here, he used the word law there. Therefore, you know, gee, when he called it a law, that was when he thought it was a law. Then he says the rate of profit has a tendency to fall. He doesn't use the word law. He must be rejecting the idea that there's a law here. I mean, it's just nonsense.
Is Harvey becoming an under-consumptionist theory? I mean, he's agreeing with the Monthly Review. He seems to be advocating for some under-consumptionist ideas in this essay. How has he backtracked here, and what do you think accounts for it?
Well, this was rather surprising to me because, as I mentioned, I quote not only, you know, from his recent article on the fall in the rate of profit and crisis theory, but from a 2012 essay of his was published in the journal Historical Materialism. And so we're getting from some time in 2012 to the end of 2014, the space of less than 3 years, he's taking the same passage of Marx and giving two entirely different and, in fact, incompatible interpretations of that passage. Okay? Mm-hmm. In 2012, he takes a passage. This is the famous passage that the underconsumptionists always trot out, and they always take it out of context. They don't tell you the context. At one point, Marx says the ultimate reason for all real crises is the restricted consumption of the masses. You take that out of context, it sounds, gee, Marx is an underconsumptionist. And, you know, you Google that, you probably find 100,000 hits or something. Very popular thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is the way that Harvey tries to use that now at the end of 2014 to say, well, if wages are low, then we're going to have a problem of a lack of effective demand due to the restricted consumption of the masses. They're not buying stuff. In his 2012 essay, Harvey takes the same passage. In that case, he looks at the context. He takes the sentence and talks about the entire passage in which it appears and gives really a diametrically opposite reading. He says, you know, if there's a demand problem, you know, which there often is, it's not because of the restricted consumption of the masses, because their consumption is always restricted, whether there's a temporary demand problem or not. Okay, the expansion of value, the surplus value, the additional output, there's got to be a demand for that, and it's not going to come from the masses. It's not going to come from the workers. It's going to come from capital itself through new investment, essentially. Okay. Now, to say that then the lack of effective demand is not a problem of the underconsumption of the masses, but is a problem of the lack of investment spending or capital accumulation of the capitalist firms themselves, it's hard to think of anything more diametrically opposite than those two things.
Yeah. So why is he walking that back here? Do you have any idea what's changed? Or maybe not. Maybe I'm asking for too much for you, but...
Well, I would suggest that you get David Harvey on the show. I mean, yeah. I think he might know better. Then again, he might not know why he's doing things. People don't always know why they do things. My only guess is that the 2014 version, where it's the restricted consumption of the masses that is the cause of the lack of demand that we have in crises, that has an immediate context of trying to make the law of the natural fall and rate of profit look monocausal, to dismiss it, to say that something else was the cause of the crisis. There's an immediate context there, and there wasn't when he was writing in 2012. He was talking about something else, I think. So, you know, when the actual politics and the immediate explanation of the crisis is at issue, maybe there's a predisposition to go in a different direction.
Put this into today's context a bit, and I'm going to ask you about Syriza, which is not on here, but I just it seems to me that when we look at the real world of politics, we can start to see how this kind of thinking, which is opportunistic thinking, can lead us astray and keep us from understanding like what's really happening in the world. What do you think the political implications are here, and maybe in terms of Syriza, maybe in terms of something else, but
the political implications of the debate over the fall and the rate of profit.
Yeah, that and the political implications of coming up with basically the wrong answer, no matter what it takes to – I mean, but when I look at the way people are apologists for Syriza and when I take a look at how people attack Syriza, I see the same problem. Like no one wants to actually look at what's happening in Greece and what their options really are. It's always like the people who are most viciously critiquing them are critiquing them because they're backstabbers or, you know, they are bourgeois or something like that. And the people who are defending them are defending them for the same kinds of reasons that people would defend George Bush. They say stuff like, when have you ever been the president of the United States? It's a tough job, kind of thing, you know. These people are facing a lot of real pressure that you could never imagine, that kind of thing. And so, but then no one's talking about, like, what's happening in Greece and what the implications are for the rest of Europe, at least not on the far left. So that's one political consequence, is that we make ourselves irrelevant. But what else is What else would you
want? Yeah, I mean, I think it's really deleterious to politics to adopt the norms and practices of bourgeois politics. And the opportunism and, the crudest kind of pragmatism that gets adopted, that's basically what you – opportunism, I think, is the word you use. That's what's being reflected in a lot of this. And hell, if you want opportunism, you want crude pragmatism, we got a lot of politicians that are really, really good at them, really good at these things. Why would masses of people want to change the world, put their lives on the line, when they've already got that? They're going to want left-leaning opportunists no, they don't want that. People will put their lives on the line for a real change. So I really think that there are a lot of consequences of opportunism that just don't get appreciated because people focus on the immediate. And we're always being drawn to the immediate in a very well, it's basically an underhanded way. In other words, you're put in a position where you exclude everything from consideration that has brought you to a situation where there really are no options or very few options and no good options. And then you're asked, okay, what would you do about just this? I don't want to hear about, what led to this. And I don't want to hear about, what role Syriza played in bringing itself into the situation in which it's running a government that's trapped. I want you to tell me how Syriza, without any real strong foundations in, the masses, it's a political party that tries to appeal to them, but it's not really their party. I want you to tell me how Syriza on its own, without that real strong backing in the masses, and, cut off basically from the main body of thought in the European currency union. Okay, how can it overcome the situation in which it's trapped? Well, it doesn't have many options, but is it impractical to say, gee, we got to look at what caused this and what maybe can be done in the future to not get yourself in a position like this? And maybe what can be done now to reverse this situation in which there are no options? You can say we're not going to play this game anymore. There's a lot of things that can still be done, but the idea that we have to constrain ourselves to the most narrow understanding of what's in front of us is, I think, very, very unfortunate. And it always gets done again and again. You get a war, and it's like, well, we're not going to be able to stop the war because we haven't had the preparation, that's needed for that, theoretically, in terms of preparing a movement and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so then we're forced to choose, one set of thugs against another set of thugs,
Mm-hmm.
No, we really don't have to. And the really practical thing to do in a situation like that is to call attention to the fact that what we need are other choices and not to be in another situation like this. Where we have to choose the U.S. versus Saddam Hussein, the U.S. versus ISIS, and so forth and so on.
Right.